Enigma by Yahtzee, read by Parika. Summary. Written for the following prompt, Eric dies or finds a magical reversey time mutant or a magical time-traveling device and wakes up in the past. This time, though, it's before he even met Charles. In fact, it's before his mother died. He can save his mother that one time, thanks to his mastery over powers carrying back. But what does Eric do after that? Does he stick around or escape and run to find Charles again and hope everything doesn't go wrong?
I only see my goals. I don't believe in failure, 'cause I know the smallest voices, they can make it major. I got my boys with me.
It leads the news in many nations, perhaps most. Charles Xavier, best known advocate for mutant rights, has died after a brief battle with lymphoma. He passed away in his bed, the stories report, surrounded by his devoted students and friends. This detail is no doubt intended to be comforting. Magneto, who reads this in a Buenos Aires cafe, can take no comfort. His hands tremble, the newspaper shakes. I think he was holding on, waiting, teacher Aurora Monroe is quoted as saying. But finally he let go. Now he's at peace. Magneto knows who Charles was waiting for, in vain. The words of the newsprint become unreadable, and no matter how hard he blinks, no matter how hard he tries to focus on the greater implications of Charles' death, what will the X-Men do now? Who leads them? Will they have as much trust from world governments? His vision blurs again and again. Finally, he puts the paper aside and surrenders, an anonymous old man weeping over his morning coffee. A few people glance his way with pity, and he can't summon the energy to hate them for it. Over the next few weeks, Magneto cannot come to terms with the fact that he did not go to Charles while he was ill. No, he didn't understand the severity of Charles' sickness, or how little time they had. But those true and just excuses don't erase the thought of Charles lying on his deathbed, wishing for Eric, who never came. Before long, he finds himself thinking that he can't stand it, that he won't stand it. He never mentions his idea to Mystique, the one person who might be able to talk him out of it. They speak of Charles's death only briefly. She claims not to mourn him. Magneto concludes she's telling the truth, and his depression deepens, as does his resolve. The mutant called Mobius has been on his radar for some time, though he never thought to seek her services. Her gift is a dangerous one. A desperate measure, one Magneto is increasingly determined to take. When he buys his tickets to Johannesburg, he considers sending a letter or email to Mystique explaining himself. But how ridiculous that impulse is. If this works, she would never receive it, because they'd both be in a world where he never had reason to put it in the mail. Mobius does not give him her real name. She might be any other sophisticated woman in Johannesburg, though lovelier than most. Her white linen shirt dress seems to glow in the dusky atmosphere of the cafe she named for their meeting, and her thick curls frame her face like a dark halo. "You'll pay a heavy price," she warns. "If it's money you want, I have it." "Yes, I want your money. But that is not what I mean." She leans her chin into her hand, gazing at him across the table. A shaft of late afternoon light catches the fizzing bubbles in her glass of sparkling water. "I've heard from various customers over the years. All of them say the same thing. They get what they want, But they pay a price that's colder than cash. The price of getting what you want is losing what you have. Magneto makes a dismissive gesture. I have very little to lose. Mobius tilts her head. Maybe, but many of them said they lost what they loved most.
I already have.
So you think, she says. In time, you will not be able to tell where my work ends and the new world begins. Her hand reaches out towards his. Now?
Are you not ready?
I am. I merely wish to know what to expect.
She shrugs.
You'll go back to the turning point.
Which turning point?
It seemed to Magneto that there have been several in his life. The real one, the most important one. I don't know which, and maybe you don't either, but my power, it always knows. Magneto decides it doesn't matter. Whatever moment is chosen will have to fall before Charles's death. He will still have a chance to say goodbye.
Very well.
Her soft hand closes over his, and the world he knows disappears.
Odpocznij, moje dziecko, dzień się skończył.
He opens his eyes, and he is Eric Lenscher. He is hardly more than a boy, and he is walking through the mud on his way to the gates of Auschwitz. No, not this again. Never did Eric dream he could go back this far. He cannot possibly endure reliving this. Come, Eric, it will be all right. His mother's arm closes around his shoulders, and Eric looks up at her in wonder. She is here. She is here. His mother is alive, smiling at him, holding him. And on his other side is Papa, dignified despite his rags and hunger. No matter what comes, Eric knows it has already been worth it just to see them again. I love you, he says quickly. I love you both, and I always will.
My good boy. Jacob Lenscher says.
His hand rests briefly atop Eric's head, and the pressure of his fingers is comforting even through his cloth cap. Even as he faces his own death, he is thinking only of his son. I can't, Eric thinks. I can't lose them again. But this time, he feels the metal of the gate singing to him. He knows the outline of every gun. Every bullet, every button and buckle, with the sharpness and control of a lifetime spent honing his gift. And he realizes with a shock that he doesn't have to lose them. He stops in his tracks. Every gun the Nazi guards possess flies upwards in an instant. The metal gates curl downwards, and the barbed wire wilts like withering vines. A few of the weapons remain just overhead, pointing downward at the Nazis. As people cry out in disbelief and shock, Eric turns to the nearest Nazi and says coolly,
"Turn over your vehicle if you want to live."
The reply he gets is, "Fuck you, you Yid bastard!" The weapons all go off in unison. A few dozen Nazis drop to the ground, dead. Eric! His mother leans close to him. Concern is written over Eddie Lenscher's face. Is this like the trick where you move the fork across the table?
Yes, Mama.
But it is so much more. Within 10 minutes, he has pulled out all the metal support beams of the various structures that make up Auschwitz. Within half an hour, every Jewish prisoner is free. And every Nazi is dead. Amid the mayhem, a man in a gray suit and glasses strides out.
What is the meaning of this? Shouts Sebastian Shaw.
What is going on here? Several of the longtime prisoners cower from him. They have learned to be afraid of this man and his rage. So has Eric. But this time, Eric knows. Shaw has no idea what to expect, and he has no helmet, no Emma Frost, no defenses whatsoever. He takes a coin from Shaw's own pocket and bores it slowly into his skull. This time, he knows enough to make Shaw's death last longer. This time, Charles doesn't have to suffer along with him. That makes his second death even sweeter than the first. Within an hour, the former prisoners of Auschwitz are loaded onto the trucks and cars that belong to a group of very dead Nazis. They drive towards the nearest woods, because nobody is entirely sure what else to do. "My brilliant boy," his mother says, stroking her hands through his hair. The desolate woods around them are dark and frightening as the night comes on. Rain still patters down all around them. "What will you do next?" "I don't know," Eric says. But then he does.
Well, now, Stalin wasn't stalling when he told the beast of Berlin that they'd never rest content till they had driven him from the land. So we called the Yanks and English and proceeded to extinguish the Fuhrer and his vermin. This is how it all began.
His military knowledge of the Second World War is, in fact, surprisingly thin. Eric could follow no battlefield news from within Auschwitz, and he's always avoided the books, classes, and documentaries that might have taught him more, but forced him to relive his worst memories. So he starts with the simplest plan of attack: find Nazis and kill them. This takes him from Poland, down into the Balkans, east into Russia, up through Scandinavia. He frees Norway, then Denmark, then the Netherlands. Long before the historical date of D-Day, the Axis is crumbling, and the Allies make landfall uncontested. Eric is not yet 15 when he first meets Winston Churchill. His principal memories of the event are of the smell of cigar smoke, the awe at meeting one of the very few humans he considers extraordinary, and the question Churchill poses him: "What are your plans after the war?" "I'm not sure," Eric says. "Spend some time with my family at peace. And then, I'd like to see America someday. President Roosevelt is my very dear friend, and I promise he will welcome you with open arms." Churchill's broad bulldog face splits in a grin. "Where do you want to visit, my lad?" "Westchester County, New York." Both the certainty and specificity of his answer make Churchill laugh out loud. "That can be arranged. You know, you might have a brilliant career ahead of you in the military." "I'm not a weapon," Eric says. "I'm not going to fight your wars at your bidding." "You seem to be fighting one now." "This is my war." Eric says it as if it were his only war. At the moment, it seems as though it truly is. VE Day arrives 6 months before it otherwise would have, 8 months after the last concentration camp has fallen. Too many millions dead already, before Eric came back. But millions more survive. He dances with his parents in the streets of Paris that night, and his father lets him have what he believes to be Eric's first taste of champagne. In many ways, the first few years after the war are the most difficult. Fighting the war, that was glorious in its way. Peace has never been as easy to him. Eric is, of course, on the lookout for prejudice against mutants, for the rise of the next oppressors and the next battle. But two things prevent him. First, the only mutant the world knows about is a hero. Eric manages to remain anonymous for the time being, but newsreels, war correspondents, and even books begin to tell the tale of a young man with incredible powers, who turned the tide of the war and saved the lives of countless Allied soldiers. One book calls him the Allies' own enigma, meaning that he was like the supposedly unbreakable Nazi code, the one great secret weapon. The suggestion that there might be others like him out there is met not with suspicion or fear, but with hope and joy. It won't last, of course. Eric knows better. But, for now at least, it is so. Second, and by far more difficult, is the fact that he is again a child, and a child with parents who expect to be obeyed. Eric has not cowed to the will of another since he escaped Auschwitz the first time and left Sebastian Shaw behind. Now, suddenly, two of the three people he's loved most in his life are here demanding that he go to bed on time, do his homework, and brush his teeth after meals. He tolerates it. Sometimes he enjoys it. Seeing his parents flourish after the war is the greatest gift Eric could imagine. Jacob begins practicing medicine again, this time in Amsterdam, a city Eric quickly learns to like. Eddie begins teaching ancient languages at the university. Once again, Eric walks through his family home and smiles in wonder at the volumes of ancient Greek lying around, at the black leather medical bag beside the door. It is so like before, yet more joyous, because this time it can go on and on. This time they are also richer. While Eric's services were, of course, given gladly and freely, several Allied governments presented him with resettlement funds that have set the lenchers up nicely. It was enough money to go to Israel, and both his parents thought that a good idea, but Eric asked them not to go. Israel, noble experiment though it is, has become something he can only see as a distraction. They indulge him in this. Eric deals with high school as best he can. He gets only middling grades, though. In science, his essay on plate tectonics is laughed at, and history focuses on eras he now finds remote. In literature, he sits directly behind Anne Frank, which is incredibly distracting. And there's no point in studying when she always gets the top grade in the class. Schoolwork is far from his only concern. His hormones surge, leaving him with moods no less overpowering for his greater perspective. And he once again has to live through the countless little indignities of adolescence. His voice cracking, wet dreams, even acne. This time, he doesn't bother chasing girls. In a rush of unexpected idealism, he decides it's fine with him if he comes to Charles a virgin, at least in body. He can manage with his hand and his fantasies until then. But this is frustrating, as is having a curfew and homework, and every once in a while his temper boils over. "I don't see the point," Eric shouts at his mother, his beloved mother, the one whose memory had the power to make him weep over 40 years after her death. "Why must I go to the party if I don't want to meet anyone there?" "To be polite," she insists. "And why shouldn't you want to meet anyone there? Dr. Van Horen has a daughter your age, you know, and surely she has many friends who will come too." "I don't want to meet any girls." "Don't you? Has it ever occurred to you, Mama, that I might be more interested in meeting boys?" As soon as the words leave his mouth, Eric regrets them. This is not a conversation he needs to have with his mother. Not ever. The thought of her confronting his homosexuality, of being disappointed in her son, horrifies him. But it does not horrify her. "Ugh, my Eric, is that why you are so angry?" Her voice is so gentle. "Is this the weight you carry inside you?" He can hardly utter the next words. "You saw that?" "You are my son. Of course I see. Did you think I would despise you for it? My poor boy. Mama's hand combs through his hair. You don't remember your Uncle Franz and Uncle Heinrich at all, do you? The Gestapo came for them even before they came for us. But they were my good friends at university. They played bridge like masters. Her smile is fond, wistful. As a gift they gave to us the blanket you slept under as a baby. How they doted on you. Eric has never been one to expect tolerance, even from Mama. It staggers him. And Papa? He loved them as I did, and he loves you. But would you rather I told him? Yes, Eric admits. Then he hugs his mother, burying his face in her shoulder as if he were a little child again. So wrong what happened to them, she whispers. Her thoughts are on her dead friends as much as on her son. And to Eric, this seems only right. They came for the Jews, the gypsies, the homosexuals, the blind and lame. Nobody should die for being what they were born. Really, they were only killed for being human. The words resonate in Eric, so deep it's like being turned inside out. Mama says, "You go to the party, just to be polite, but you don't have to stay long, and you need not ask any girls to dance." She pats his shoulder. When the time comes, and you have a young man you like, you bring him home to us. For the first time, it occurs to him that he might someday introduce Charles to his parents. My God, he thinks, they'll adore each other. And it takes all his strength not to cry. During Eric's university years in France, an American film studio releases a movie called Enigma of the Allies. He goes to see it with some people from school, staring with bemusement at this muddled version of his life. Perhaps he has no right to argue about inaccuracies, as he is the one who insisted on anonymity and secrecy. He can understand the filmmaker's assumptions that he was a young man rather than a mere boy. Besides, it's flattering to be played by Montgomery Clift. But the romance is rather far-fetched by even Hollywood standards, and Audrey Hepburn's character is far too well-groomed for the front. Hepburn worked with the Dutch resistance, however, so he decides that counts as realism of a sort. What strikes him the most is how often Enigma is shown using his powers. The effects are crude, at least to his eyes, which recall the cinematic wonders of later decades. However, each time, the audience goes mad with excitement. There are cheers when U-boats are ripped from the Atlantic, or when Allied landing craft float safely from their carriers to the waiting shore. "Wouldn't it be amazing to be a mutant?" whispered one girl from his study group. The others nod. At the end, when Montgomery Clift kisses Audrey Hepburn, as a Nazi flag is torn down in the background, the audience erupts in applause. Eric starts laughing, and he can't stop, not until long afterward. By then, all his companions are annoyed that he seems to be mocking such a good movie, one about a real hero. His marks in college are even worse than they were in high school, because Eric has belatedly discovered the concept of having fun. Really, he never got to be young the first time round. His first memories include harassment, oppression, worry. Only now does Eric find out what being carefree is like. Only now does he discover how to waste time, how to relax, how to play. It's not the same for him as it is for his friends. He has several. humans, the lot of them. And yet, he feels sure they're not the wrong sort. There's always a shadow within him, the pain of his first life's losses, the knowledge of the hatred of mutants that is no doubt coming. But Eric is learning how to set that aside and live in the moment. He didn't do that often enough before. One night, he and his friends wind up drinking a few bottles of wine in the park. It's a new moon, so Anouk leaves on the battery of her car. The headlights shine behind them, like they are performing in front of a screen of light. Jazz streams from the car stereo as he dances barefoot on the grass with the girls, then one of the boys, when everyone can pretend they're just being silly. Eric remembers what it's like to have an old body, to no longer feel the ever-flowing vitality of youth. The others have to persuade him to finally leave long after midnight. This time, there will be no Cuban Missile Crisis, as Sebastian Shaw is no longer around to provoke it. So Eric will require a different introduction to Charles Francis Xavier. Ultimately, Eric decides he might as well pursue graduate school and get to know him there. If they meet a few years earlier, then those are years he can spend with Charles. Yes, a longer relationship will make the break more painful when it comes, but that's a price he's willing to pay. Despite his lackluster academic career, Eric gets into Oxford. No doubt, a recommendation letter authored by Winston Churchill helps. He's been preparing himself for the moment since before Mobius sent him back, but Eric finds himself utterly unready to see Charles again. Charles is standing near the back of a pub where the grad students have gathered the night before classes start. For a long while, Eric simply stares at him, a mop of brown hair, a young, unlined face, and eyes even bluer than his memories. Although Charles is acting much like the same careless boy he did when they first met, his behavior looks different to Eric now. Maybe it's because Charles is a bit younger and less experienced in his man-of-the-world act. Maybe it's because Eric has so much more knowledge of Charles and of life. For whatever reason, Eric sees how vulnerable Charles is, and how much of his drinking and braggadocio is merely an attempt to fit into a mold others will understand and accept. It touches him, moves him, almost as much as the mere sight of Charles, young, healthy, standing, strong, and alive. So Eric works his way through the crowd towards Charles. His heart pounds. When he finally reaches Charles' side, he clears his throat and says, Eric Lenscher.
Oh, hello. Charles Xavier. Good to know you.
Charles gives him a friendly glance that lasts about 2 seconds before he launches right back into another joke for the group of new friends already laughing around him. Eric is perfectly welcome to join them, he realizes, but he has not made any particular impression. The more he thinks about this, the stupider he feels. Why did he assume it would be exactly like before? That almost instantaneous connection, the immediate intimacy of the spirit, the attraction that underlay every word and gesture from almost the time they met. Apparently bumping into each other at a mixer doesn't have the same emotional impact as a desperate rescue from the depths of the sea. Eric hangs in there. They do wind up talking, more and more as the night goes on, mostly anecdotes about their college exploits. But at least Eric has some tales of his own to share. The group around them dwindles slowly, and by the time Charles is ready to leave the party, Eric is the only one by his side. As they walk along the cobbled stone street, Eric says, "So, you work on human mutation?" That's right. How did you know that? I don't remember talking about it at the pub.
I heard.
Are you by chance a telepath?
Charles says, so casually that Eric has to stare at him.
I am, though my skills are a bit... Let's say I'm working on them. My sister's a mutant too, shapeshifter.
You should see her real skin sometime. It's fab. Bright blue.
You tell everyone that you're a mutant?
Why shouldn't I?
This timeline has somehow made Charles even more naive. Eric lets that pass for a moment, though. If he is to teach Charles caution this time around, he will not be able to do so without trust. Beginnings are so important.
I'm not a telepath, Eric says, but I am a mutant.
Brilliant! Charles grins. His steps quicken on the stones, lighten, until it seems as if he's on the verge of skipping in boyish glee.
Why didn't you say so at the pub? What is it that you can do?
By now, Eric is smiling too. He takes the metal clip from Charles's tie, levitates it into the air between them, and winds the gold into a hoop that spins between them. Its surface glints in the moonlight. Charles' eyes widen.
Metal?
And magnetism.
Are you... You couldn't be, but I never heard of another mutant who could...
My God, you are!
Charles literally staggers back a step, and his voice is hardly more than a whisper when he manages to say,
You're Enigma.
Eric wants to deny it, but he can't understand why. What's the point? Charles will ultimately know the truth anyway.
I am.
I can't believe it. You were my hero when I was a boy.
And this time, you were mine, Eric wants to say. Instead, he holds on to his parents' old rule.
Our secret, all right?
Of course, if you insist. But why don't you want to tell the world who you are? What you did? For the Allies? For mutants? For all of us?
If I were you, I'd never shut up.
Charles starts laughing, though it's as much shock as humor. My mother and father wanted me to grow up without that kind of attention. Now that I'm an adult, I see the wisdom of it.
Charles draws himself up, almost formal.
It's an honor.
This is a wretched beginning.
Don't act that way. I liked it better when we were drinking at the pub like friends.
Eric tries to be casual about the rest, though it's hard.
We can be friends, can't we?
Yes, absolutely. I just...
Give me a minute.
Charles puts one hand to his chest, takes a deep breath.
And you... You'll actually let me study you?
Oh, yes. Eric has to stifle a wicked grin.
It's just a matter of time.
Yet, they don't go to bed that night, that week, or even that month. They become fast friends, dear friends, and there they stay. Eric understands why. Charles once confided that he'd had only one male lover before Eric, and that only in his last year at Oxford. At this point, he must only still be coming around to the idea of his bisexuality. So this will take time. Despite sexual frustration to the point of insomnia, Eric enjoys the waiting more than not. Whatever else Charles was to him, he was also Eric's dearest friend, and now they have time to luxuriate in that friendship. Their chess games are a daily ritual, just like tea. They walk each other to class, to the pub. Every once in a while, on weekends, Raven joins them. She walked around blue all the time. All the time. And Charles is as proud of her as she is of herself. People comment, but always nicely. Usually women saying how striking her white dresses are against her complexion. She always wears white. Or men trying to pick her up. Eric is, of course, prepared to be her friend and confidant in this lifetime, too. But she doesn't seem to need one. Nor is she madly in love with Charles this go-round. There's no psychological need to burrow into the heart of her family, into the great mansion on Grey Malkin Lane, and never emerge again. This raven is sure that the world will love and accept her, and Eric doesn't have the heart to tell her she's wrong. Not yet. Mostly, though, he and Charles are alone, and, to his astonishment, Eric finds himself learning things about Charles he never knew before. "You don't seem to have read my mind at all," Eric ventures one evening, when by chance almost no one else is in the pub. "Are you sure you're a telepath?" "Pretty sure," Charles says, but he doesn't laugh at the joke, or rummage around in Eric's mind to prove he can. "My powers have been all but latent for years, though. I can force myself to get in someone's head, enough to read their most dominant emotions, at least. But it's been a long time since I literally read thoughts the way I did as a child." Eric frowns. Many mutants don't manifest until adolescence, or even later. But he's never heard of a latent period. "Why?" Charles stares down at his half-downed pint of oatmeal stout. "My father died when I was quite young. My mother remarried a man named Kurt Marco, who had a son about my age. Kane." The names come haltingly to him, as if he has to work to speak them out loud. "Marco only loved my mother's money, really. Kane hated him, my mother, me, Raven, all of us, everyone." This much Eric knew. He nods. But Charles continues. "Then, my telepathy was so natural to me. I read everyone, all the time. I couldn't not read them, do you understand? It was like hearing for a person who isn't deaf. Automatic, natural, a part of me." He takes another swallow, clearly trying to brace himself. "And when I revealed their worst intentions, my God, how they would take it out of me. Kane was simpler. He'd just beat me up. But Kurt, he'd humiliate me in front of my mother, lead her to distrust anything I said, to dislike me. And then he'd beat me. Raven. Once, when I was hiding from him, Raven took my shape so he'd beat her instead. And when I found her afterwards and saw what she'd done, what Kurt Marco had done to her, I swore to myself I'd never get in trouble again. Not ever." How did Eric never know this? How? But then, the time when he and Charles were this close was so short before. And Charles was trying so hard to save Eric that Eric never once asked himself if he should be saving Charles, too. He looked at that enormous mansion and saw only the wealth it represented. To Charles, before the mansion became the school, it could only have been a prison. Charles clears his throat. "I didn't consciously stop reading minds, but something inside me shut down. A defensive mechanism, the Freudians would say." "Charles." Eric strokes his hand along Charles's arm, only remembering afterward that he doesn't get to touch him like that yet. But Charles is too caught up in his memory to notice. "You'll get your abilities back. I know it." "I'm working on it. When the barriers fall, it will be over. I know that. But..." Eric realizes that's not the comfort Charles needs. "They shouldn't have done that to you." "Do you know, the happiest day I had during that time was when I went to see that movie about you? The one with Montgomery Clift. I imagined you coming to save me." I should have. I would have if I'd known. Eric. Charles' voice is soft. When their eyes meet, Eric feels a thrill shiver throughout his body, and he suspects it's mutual. A week after that, just before classes end for the year, Eric and Charles sit up late in Charles's room. Their academic gowns are rumpled on the floor, beside a pile of books and a nearly empty bottle of wine. The lights are off, save for one lamp with a golden shade. "Just try," Eric murmurs. Charles hesitates. They are standing very close. "It might help if I touched you." "Then touch me." Eric closes his eyes as Charles's hands cup his face. It takes all his will not to tow Charles towards the bed. But this isn't about a pass. This is about helping Charles rediscover himself. He realizes that he wants Charles to read his mind, wants him to know everything at last. Though, of course, he won't be able to delve that deeply yet. "Okay, hold on." Charles takes a deep breath, and Eric projects the main thing he wants Charles to understand: how much Eric loves him. For a long while, nobody speaks or moves. There's no sense of another mind curling around his own. Eric wonders if it isn't working. He opens his eyes to see Charles staring at him, and there's nothing Eric's seen in either lifetime more beautiful than the expression of wonder. "Oh," Charles whispers. Eric remains very still for the time it takes Charles to slowly, so slowly, lean close and tilt his face upwards for their first kiss. Their first time was desperate, passionate, almost unbearably intense. Their second first time is gentle and slow. They know each other. They trust each other. Charles is curious about how this will work, and Eric shows him, bit by bit. At the ultimate moment, as Eric goes down on Charles, his mind feels the brush of Charles's mind. More ephemeral than he recalls, but it's there, seeking him unconsciously, trying to share both the emotion and the pleasure. And as Charles comes, crying out, enough of his pleasure spills over Eric to bring him off too. They lie together in each other's arms afterward, silent and content. Eric wonders how it's possible for something so quiet and soft to be even better than what they had before. Charles breaks the silence. "You know, when I saw that movie, I never dreamed I'd be Audrey Hepburn." Eric laughs until Charles hushes him with kisses. They're going to spend the break in London, just them, as Raven's off with her latest boyfriend. But just before they're due to leave Oxford, a trunk call comes from Amsterdam. Jacob Lenscher has had a heart attack, and he is not expected to survive. Charles comes with him, rushing to make every train, handling the bags. By the time they arrive, Papa is unconscious, and Mama is weeping so brokenly that Eric can hardly bear the sound. "It won't be long," the doctors say. "Hours, if that." As he holds her at her bedside, he murmurs, "I didn't get to say goodbye." Why did Eric never consciously consider the fact that he would have so many goodbyes to say this time? "Take your mother's hand," Charles says. Eric does so, realizing only then that he hadn't even introduced Charles yet. "Why?" "Let's try this." Charles stretches his arms, simultaneously grasping both Eric's free hand and one of Papa's. "Close your eyes." There, in the darkness behind his eyelids, Eric feels Charles's presence, and Mama's, and Papa, still here, fragmented somehow, but still himself. Eric's throat tightens as he realizes how frightened his father is. Then more as his fear subsides, replaced by joy at the presence of his son and his wife here in his own mind. They are together as a family in a way they have never been before or will be again. But it's enough, because the love burns brighter than the encroaching dark, and his father is not alone. Eric and Mama hold him, shelter him. In the last moments, when Papa flickers away like a candle's flame, it's even more beautiful than painful. After the immediate rush of tears, Mama turns to Charles and says, "Thank you. There are no words for such a gift." Charles is crying harder than either of the Lenchers. He just nods. Eric puts one hand on his shoulder. "Mama, this is Charles." She understands. Eric had known she would.
Oh, raindrops, so many raindrops, it feels like raindrops falling from my eyes, falling from my eyes.
What he had not known was that Charles would practically turn into her favorite. They visited Amsterdam again in the spring. She comes to London in the summer, and before long she's bought a flat there. "I have to keep you fed," she says, spooning yet more matzo ball soup into Charles's bowl. Charles begins to get a bit soft around the waist. Eric loves that softness. He loves his second family, Mama and Charles, and even Raven when she bothers to drop by between love affairs. He loves helping Charles through his doctoral work, and periodically does some studying himself. If there is a single happiest time of his life, either life, this is it. "Look at him, the proud man of the house," Eddie says one night when they're visiting her in London as Charles attacks the challah bread. "My Eric, so prosperous and happy. When he was younger, ugh, he was so angry." "You had your reasons for anger," Charles points out. "My God, the whole planet owes Eric a debt for what his anger wrought." "Not the war. Of course, we were all angry during the war. But afterward, it was as if he carried the weight of the world and hated the burden. Not any longer. Thanks to you, I think." "And to you. And to this, what did you call it?
Challah?"
Eric rises from the table, disquieted. Mama chit-chats on, but Charles's blue eyes watch him go. Though he hides his reaction as best he can, it's more difficult to conceal things from Charles than it used to be. As his psychic powers increase, Eric's privacy decreases. If only he knew where Sebastian Shaw found that damned helmet. Once, Eric knew its composition as well as he knew the shape of his own face. But that was decades ago, another lifetime. Where is his anger? It is the fuel that has powered him on, that has sustained him when he was alone, focused him when he was lost. Even after he lost his family, even after the break with Charles, even as humanity grew ever more suspicious of mutants, Eric knew he would be able to go on. The fire within would never die out. He thought it as much a part of him as his flesh. Yet here he is, happy, content, comfortable. And all he really wants is for his life to stay just like this forever. He excuses himself for a walk, though it's cool and the mists in the London air are very close to rain. After half an hour of solitude, he's even more agitated than before, but is at least relieved to think Charles left him to himself. Then he turns the corner to see Charles sitting on a bench. He's wearing a rain slicker and looking. Eric has no words for how he looks, But whatever it is makes him want to forget about war and take Charles in his arms. So instead, he glances away. "I'll know where you're turning before you do," Charles warns, before Eric can walk off. "If you know that, then you know I'd rather be alone." "I'll leave you alone once I'm sure you're all right. The distress you're in. Eric, this is worse than anything I've sensed in you since your father's death. Please, tell me what's wrong." Eric snaps. "How can you not know?" "I don't pry. You shouldn't have to pry. It's a part of me, the most important thing about me. How have you not sensed it? How can you not know?" Charles rises to his feet, shaking his head. "I know you're frightened, as if you've lost something, angry with yourself, but I can't make out the rest." His forehead furrows. "There's always been a quality to your thoughts unlike anyone else's, as though everyone else were an open book, but with you, every other page is obscured. Mirror writing, perhaps, or in code. I can't read it, even if I know it's there." Eric stares at him. "You've always known I was different, then. I assumed it was part of your mutation." Charles balls his hands in the pockets of his raincoat. "It's not, is it?" Mobius's gift must include the ability to cover her own tracks. "No." "And what's scaring you now has to do with that? It's written on the pages I can't read?" When Eric nods, Charles steps closer to him, so damn worried for him that it breaks Eric's heart. "Whatever it is, just tell me. Tell me, and we'll face it together." From the beginning, Eric has wondered what would happen when Charles learned the truth. And he always assumed Charles would, though he thought telepathy would be the reason why. He expected anger, repugnance even, shock certainly. But as he looks down at Charles, Eric finds himself not at all certain that the truth will end them. He has always loved Charles. Only now does he realize that this is the first time he's completely trusted him. "Sit beside me." Eric guides them both to the park bench, the water beaded on the seat, soaked through his slacks as he talks, on and on, starting at the beginning, the real beginning. He tells Charles the story of both their lives, as they unspooled the first time, and he holds absolutely nothing back. Charles says not a word. His expression remains inscrutable. It's nearly midnight by the time Eric's done. They sit in silence a few long minutes as Charles takes it in. Finally, unable to endure the suspense any longer, Eric says, "Do you think I'm insane?" "You're quite sane, and you're telling the truth." "You can see it in my mind now?" "No, those memories are closed off to me, to any telepath in this version, timeline, whatever we should call it. But I feel the honesty inside you." Charles leans back to stare at him, and slowly he says, "You began all this just to tell me goodbye?" Eric nods. Maybe it seems trivial. But then he realizes how bright Charles's eyes are now, that the water running down his cheeks isn't only the rain. "You're not the man you were before," Charles says hoarsely. "That much is clear." "That's what scares me. That's the reason I'm not scared."
To me, gently.
They argued afterwards, of course, but not about anything personal. The points of debate are very familiar, at least at first. How can you be so certain that humanity is going to attack mutant kind? Charles insists. They have this cabin on the train back to Oxford to themselves, so they can talk openly. I told you, I've been to the future, I've seen it, it happens. First of all, what you described to me fell rather short of an all-out race war. It was beginning, Eric insists. Even if I concede that, which I don't, Eric, that was another world completely. This world isn't so different. Are you mad? It's transformed, and you're the one who transformed it. Charles leans closer to Eric so that he can punctuate each point with a finger to Eric's breastbone. Who won World War II for the Allies? A mutant. And everyone knows it. Mutants commonly acknowledge their powers. Or haven't you noticed that Raven walks around blue all the time? I'm not stupid. Of course I've noticed. But I'm telling you, it's only temporary. I think you're wrong. I think you don't understand how fundamentally you changed us all. What's more, the transformation doesn't have to stop with the war. When Eric frowns up at him, Charles says, Has it never occurred to you how happy the world would be to see you again? Or how much good you could do? Not just for mutants, but for everyone. You're trying to turn me into one of your X-Men. They wouldn't be the X-Men this time. Charles's eyes burn with certainty. It's like watching a moment of religious conversion. This time, we'll all be following you. Eric doesn't know whether that's what he always used to want, or whether it's the scariest thing he's ever heard. As Charles leans his head on Eric's shoulder, he murmurs, Stop looking through the lens of the past. It can only cloud your vision now. See clearly, Eric. See what you've done, what you can do. The lens of the past tells me you're an idealist. Sometimes you fail to see facts. I don't need the lens of the past to tell me that sometimes you fail to see possibilities. Charles sighs. Quite possibly, Charles is making sense. He'll have to consider it, but later. Thank you for being able to hear this, for believing me and accepting it. You don't have to thank me for that. Charles hesitates. Only one thing gave me any pause, and I'm past it already. What? Well, it was always so romantic to me, the way that you pursued me from the beginning. I didn't realize you were in love with me at first, but I knew you felt a connection the instant we met. That amazed me every time I thought of it. But it makes sense now. You'd fallen in love with me before. It doesn't take anything away, really. I know it doesn't. But I guess it's hard for me to let go of that dream. You know, love at first sight. It was love at first sight, Eric says. When we met in the other timeline, I knew before the hour was out that I'd waited my whole life to find you. I always knew. Oh, Eric.
What's your name?
Charles is very persuasive, but in the end, Eric reveals himself not by design, but in the heat of the moment. They're in London again a couple of months into their discussion on the subject, Raven with them this time, each of her arms looped in one of theirs. As they head towards Trafalgar Square, they hear a smashing sound and turn to see a car flattened against the side of a double-decker bus. The bus is wobbling, toppling onto its side. Or it would, if Eric didn't put out a hand to catch it. This he would have done in any lifetime. As Magneto, he was often ruthless, but never cruel without purpose. It's what happens next that is different. As the bus hovers there, slowly righting itself, Eric instinctively lowers his hand to hide the movement. But Charles murmurs, Don't. Maybe, just once, they could try it Charles's way. Eric steps forward and boldly lifts the bus up from the pavement by several feet, the better to place it on an even, bare patch of the street. People all around begin to murmur, but more in admiration than in fear. Then one says, "It's Enigma! Has to be!" How could they be so certain? He doesn't even look that much like Montgomery Clift. Then again, Charles caught on, didn't he? Metal control is a rare talent, even among mutants. Maybe it's his calling card. "Is it you? Really you?" a Bobby asks as the crowd begins to gather around them. "The same Enigma from the war?" Eric feels immodest, not an emotion he's had much experience with, but he nods. People go mad. It's like VE Day all over again. Eric is hugged, kissed, even handed babies to hold. By far the worst part. Charles laughs out loud, watching him fend off the well-wishers, but he shouts over the din, "They love you!" They do seem to. Next day, some photos of the events, taken by an amateur in the crowd, are in the papers with the headline, "Is this Enigma?" The aged Winston Churchill issues a statement confirming that Eric Lencher is indeed the man. But nobody starts calling him by his real name. It's always Enigma. "I prefer Magneto," Eric says to Charles that evening, as they stare at a sea of newsprint on the floor of Mama's flat. "Magneto? The name I went by before." That particular detail never came up. "Really?" Charles wrinkles his nose. "That's not even a word. Enigma's better. Besides, everybody already knows you that way." "But..." Within his mind, he hears Charles's voice. "And it's the name I used during those adolescent sexual fantasies of mine." Come to think of it, Eric does sort of like Enigma. So begins the Age of Enigma, the Age of the Mutant, as Time magazine declares. Beneath that banner, Eric is pictured in the suit he and Charles chose, dark blue and yellow, not so different from the X-Men uniforms in another lifetime. Once again, they travel to the great house on Grey Malkin Lane. Once again, they search for fellow mutants. This time, it's almost too easy. They're inundated with prospective students from day one. There are between 1,000 and 5,000 mutants in the world now, Charles estimates, and a decent fraction of the younger ones want to enroll. So they're selective. Raven, of course, and all the others they began with, from Alex Summers to Angel Salvatore to Armando Reyes. Hank McCoy is already at peace with his feet, and right away he's hard at work at his greatest inventions, the Blackbird, Sean Cassidy's Banshee suit, and above all, Cerebro. As for the early members of the Brotherhood, Azazel's dangerous to know, but Yanos is worth recruiting, and after some negotiations, Emma Frost agrees to come on board as a teacher. She's more at ease now, less frightened of the world at large. He knows how that feels. Logan is at least more polite this time. "You're Enigma, huh?" "I am." The name seems almost natural now. "Nice job kicking some Nazi ass," Logan growls around the stump of a cigar he's still smoking. "But last time I checked, there wasn't a world war going on, so I'd rather mind my own business." Charles leans forward, his forearms against the diner counter. "You've been around a long time. You're not even sure you can die." Logan pulls back.
"What the..."
"My friend is a telepath," Eric explains. Was there a time he felt nervous about Charles rummaging around in his head? He knows there was, but it's difficult to remember in anything but the abstract. "It's all right." "Logan, consider." When he wants, Charles's voice can take on the gentlest and yet most persuasive tone. The one question you can never answer is whether your longevity on this planet serves any purpose. I'm offering you an answer. Define your own purpose. Make your own way.
Your way, you mean? Logan snaps, but his expression is thoughtful.
He stalks out of the diner soon afterwards, but Eric isn't entirely surprised when, a few weeks later, Logan saunters up to the mansion like it was his own idea to come. Eddie Lencher moves in too, and takes over the kitchen. Despite her increasing age, she refuses to let anyone else help cook, and somehow keeps several dozen teenagers fed. Charles playfully argues this may be a mutation, a superpower greater than any of theirs. But it's hard to disagree. Everyone calls her Mama Lencher. Eric doesn't mind. The name they choose for themselves is Mutant Force. X-Men had more of a ring to it, Eric thinks, but that's one more piece of a vanishing past. Enigma and Mutant Force, the posters read. Big, airbrush portraits of a grinning Eric, Charles, Raven, Logan, and Alex are being sold to decorate kids' walls, dorm rooms, that kind of thing. Are we getting royalties on these? Eric says, staring at the one Sean brought home to tease them. It's currently hung on the back of the door he and Charles share, staring at them while they lie in bed together. Oh, honestly, you've never cared about money. Of course not, but I'm uneasy about this. Charles props up on one elbow. His hair has begun to thin a bit, but there's enough left to look sexily rumpled. Why? I idolized you as a boy. Other children should get the chance.
You didn't used to idolize me.
Eric really brings up the other timeline any longer. Things are so changed. But this one change, he never quite gets used to. You argued with me, fought with me. Every time I pushed, you pushed back. For a while, Charles is silent. Do you miss that? Truthfully, yes, sometimes I do. Turning over in bed to face Charles, he adds, But I love you for who you are. Never doubt that. I feel so weirdly jealous of him. The other me, I mean. The first one you loved. It's the strangest love triangle Eric can imagine. Don't be. Anyway, I fight you sometimes, Charles insists, about taking Mutant Force International, for instance.
It's time. Past time.
Invigorated, Eric continues. Yes, the Western world has a different attitude about mutants this time around. I see that now. But that's not the entire world. The Far East, Africa, South America, some areas of Eastern Europe, they remain suspicious, they discriminate, and God only knows what's going on behind the Iron Curtain. Despite State Department inquiries, Mutant Force has resolutely refused to end the Cold War. Charles got them to finally stop asking by pointing out that mutants were no more immune to nuclear weapons than humans, Logan notwithstanding. We have so much to do here, though, Eric. Even now, as much as we patrol, so many accidents and crimes fall through our fingers. They always will. We can't be everywhere at once, but we do have nearly 50 mutants field trained by now. We can't spare 5 or 6 of us to help our own people? Charles flops onto his back, considering it. Slowly, he says, I still think at this point it's an overreaction. Overreaction? But, Charles continues, better to set a precedence. Establish that we look out for mutant kind as zealously as we do humanity. That way, if and when mutants do fall prey to human prejudice, we'll already have made it clear that we won't stand idly by. Eric pauses. So, you agree? Not in the need, but on the action. You're awfully easy this go-round. Charles gives him a look. And you like it that way. By the time the resulting kissing has become foreplay, and Eric is gasping beneath Charles's ministrations, Charles murmurs, "They won't put this on a poster anytime soon." "That's going to change, you know." Eric softly bites Charles's shoulder, licks the salt from his skin. "Not soon, but eventually. Homosexuals will get to marry someday." Charles stops cold, which is disappointing, at least until Eric sees the astonishment on his face. "Wait, you mean men marrying men? That's going to be legal?" "Yes." "In the United States?" "Not in all of them when I came back, but several, New York included. We'll be quite elderly then, but I don't mind a long engagement if you don't." It's half a joke, simply because that's decades in the future. But Charles instantly gets this look on his face, like he's so happy that he doesn't dare believe it. "Are you serious?" Eric frames Charles's face with his hands. "When we're old and wrinkled, and I'm as gray as you are bald, I intend to make an honest man out of you." Charles kisses him then, and the hour that follows is so emotional, so passionate, that Eric remains in a good mood for days. That takes some of the sting out of it when Armando comes home with the Enigma lunchbox. The next decade sees Mutant Force increasing its reach and its influence worldwide. So many more mutants are public now that they consider opening a second campus. But in the end, Charles simply builds a couple new structures on the grounds. They have multiple teams. Raven, Armando, and Emma all become team leaders. By right, Charles should as well, but he prefers to govern the school and fight alongside Eric when possible. Charles is the one who convinces Eric that outreach is the answer, rather than a show of force. "Your heroism during the Second World War changed things for mutants in most of the world," he argues. "Heroism is what can change things for everyone else." Eric would disagree with this if he didn't have the proof. Also, he happens to remember the dates of a couple of severe earthquakes. So they go forth, they save lives. They walk the streets of foreign cities in their superhero costumes and allow little children to run up, ask questions, touch Logan's claws. The claws are bone rather than adamantium. William Stryker will never get his hands on Logan this time. Eric and Charles meet with world leaders when asked. He is invited to address the United Nations, which he does without mentioning to Charles, or anyone, that the last time he did this, he'd taken the entire UN hostage. But it's the day-to-day interactions with regular people that mean more. Eric sees that now. The 1960s turn into the 1970s. Men begin wearing long, shaggy hair and mustaches around the same time Charles finally goes bald. Poor man. Jean Grey comes to them as a child, around the same time Alex's brother Scott arrives at the school. Young Aurora Monroe is hardly able to do more than stir a breeze, but the potential is obvious. Eric expects a more cynical age to turn against him, but Enigma and all of mutant kind are embraced as counterculture, radical, and authentic in an artificial culture. There are at least fewer posters. This time, when the ERA is proposed for the U.S. Constitution, Charles suggests uniting with NOW to get one amendment that will enshrine equal rights for mutants along with those for women, and by the way, all adult Americans. Eric doesn't have the heart to tell him the ERA will be defeated. But it isn't this time. Apparently support for mutants put it over the top. One day Raven announces that she's pregnant, that the father isn't in the picture, and anybody who doesn't like it would be well advised to shut up. It takes Eric a little while to recall how different the attitudes are towards single mothers in this decade. And a few magazines do take pot shots. Ladies Home Journal asks whether Raven remains a fit role model, but nobody is stupid enough to do so to her face, or his. The moment the baby is born, Eric knows the identity of the father, because despite the fact that his name is Daniel Charles Xavier this time, the blue tail and impish ears could only belong to Nightcrawler. When did she meet Azazel? How? What does he mean to her? To ask would alienate her, he knows, but the questions remain with him, as do the issues they raise. Apparently fate has a part in this universe as much as free will, Eric says, as he watches Charles attempt to change the squirming infant. No matter what brought him to us, I'm glad. Charles frowns at the triangle of cloth in front of him. You know, diapering around a tail is not a task for the weak. Raven's an attentive mother. Mama happily takes on granny duty, and Charles dotes on the little thing. Eric likes him too, in as much as he likes any babies. Yet Nightcrawler inexplicably decides Logan is his favorite. To Eric's surprise, the adoration is mutual. Before long, Logan is walking around with a child perched on his shoulder, tail wrapped around Logan's arm. For all Eric's misgivings, prejudice against mutant kind only requires mass action once. Idea Mindada turns out to loathe mutants as much as he loathes virtually everyone, and after his coup d'etat in Uganda, he has the power to turn that hatred into action. After the first pogrom, mutant force goes in. Eric leads one team against the presidential palace, while Charles and Raven lead another against the forces on the field. What nobody in mutant force knows until it's too late is that Idi Amin's field troops include a mutant who has been tortured and brainwashed into doing their bidding. This mutant is a powerful psychic who can confuse all their thoughts. Raven and the others falter. Charles persists, fighting a psychic battle so great the fury of it can be felt even by the side blind. And he wins, saving the entire team, though afterwards he is dazed and incapable. Which is why a soldier was able to aim a rifle without Charles realizing it. They mean to comfort Eric when they tell him later that Charles never felt a thing, that he was probably dead before he hit the ground.
Ain't no sunshine when she's gone, and this house just ain't no home anytime she goes away.
Eric. Mama stands at the door of their bedroom, his bedroom only now, stooped and frail, yet her voice is strong. It is time. I can't. You must. No, I mustn't. Charles will be buried with or without me. Will you send him on the final journey alone? I didn't say goodbye. The one thing I wanted to do above all else, and I failed. He died without me saying goodbye. Eric leans forward, his head in his hands. His body hurts with the grief, feels weighed down by it, like he might at any moment fall to the ground and never move again. His mother totters towards him and rests her hand on his. Her skin is so thin now, crumpled and spotted like old parchment, on which is written their entire history. I know it will be hard, my son, but in years to come, you will be glad you did this. I can't face it. Can't? My son, who faced down Panzer divisions before he turned 14? He can't? Then I don't want to. I think of what it will be like hearing the dirt fall on his coffin and knowing Charles is in there. D Do you think it will be much easier for me? Mama's voice wavers. Ever since the day you brought him to us, Charles has been a second son. I keep thinking that I hear his voice or feel his touch against my mind.
So do I.
Eric holds his mother's hand to his face, and for a moment, both of them struggle for composure. When he can speak again, he chokes out,
Charles only went to Uganda because I pushed for it, to send mutant force out, to fix a fight, to create one if it didn't exist.
Not another word. For all her age and fragility, Mama seemed to tower over him. Charles was not your puppet. He was not your servant. For all that he idolized you, he was his own man, always. Charles gave his life to save thousands of others, willingly, freely. If you do not know him well enough to understand that, well, I did. I'm proud of Charles. I go to the funeral today to show the world that. Can you not do the same? Eric slowly rises from the side of the bed, which seems so large now, too large. Charles's half is unwrinkled and still. I've been acting like a child. We are none of us ourselves at these moments. She folds her hand into the crook of Eric's arm. Come, we must tell Charles farewell. There is, after all, more than one way to say goodbye.
Hey, I ought to leave the young thing alone.
The photograph appears on the front page of most newspapers. Enigma, his head bowed, tears on his cheek. Most common among the various captions is, A Hero's Farewell. It becomes an iconic image, but Eric hates it. They ought to have printed pictures of Charles.
No, I can't forget tomorrow when I think of all my sorrow. Well, I had you there, but then I let you go.
Mutant Force endures. Enigma endures. It is what Charles would have wanted. The school grows by leaps and bounds, and Eric finds himself spending more time there than in the field. Raven, Logan, Hank, they're more than capable of handling anything fate can throw at them. And Logan's attitude aside, they represent mutant kind well. Besides, it's time for humanity's acceptance of mutants to have less to do with gratitude to the wartime exploits of Enigma. Eric grieves for Charles even more deeply than before. Now, instead of a friendship and a long-ago love affair, he is mourning a shared life and nearly 20 years of happiness. Yet, paradoxically, he finds this greater grief easier to bear. Mourning what has been and gone is not so scarring to the soul as mourning what might have been. Only now does he realize that, this time, he didn't have to say goodbye to Charles. Everything Eric wanted to say, Charles already knew. And if he no longer plays chess, if he sometimes reaches in his sleep to the empty side of the bed, it only means that Charles is still remembered. Mama dies 2 years after Charles. After a few months, when she spends as much time napping as awake, she slips away peacefully in her sleep. Eric covers the mirrors, and all the resident mutants sit Shiva, some more awkwardly than others. But it is meant as tribute to Eddie Lencher, and so irregularities don't matter. They sit together on the floor and share stories about her lectures and her jokes and her wonderful cooking. There's as much laughter as tears. Once, Eric remembers what she looked like dead on the floor of Sebastian Shaw's office, blood splattered on the floor around her. It's a jolt. He hasn't thought of that in nearly 40 years. He never thinks of it again. So Eric grows older. He grows old. Enigma is a historical relic now, and the youngest students inform him that he is the most frequently searched name on a website titled Dead or Not. That isn't exactly flattering, but he's content with the lower profile. His last decades of life aren't entirely chaste. The occasional man enters his life, but he never indulges in a long-term romance. Guiding the mutant schools and rescue forces across the globe take most of Eric's time and energy, and he prefers it that way. Besides, it wouldn't be fair to ask anyone to stand in Charles's shadow. He amuses himself by noticing the discrepancies between what he distantly remembers and what is so. This time, when she becomes a young woman, Jean Grey is the one who has a terrible crush on Wolverine. But Wolverine remembers her at age 7, and lets her down gently. Raven takes up with a woman, which isn't surprising, and then fathers several children with her, which is. Eric never stops expecting Nightcrawler to speak with a German accent. One day, Emma Frost returns from a mission in Russia with an artifact she wants him to examine. "It blocks telepathy completely," she says. "If other people got their hands on this, it could be dangerous, but I thought you should see it." Eric lifts the helmet in his wrinkled hands. He finds he doesn't like to look at the thing long. "Destroy it," he says. Scott does the honors. Very late in his life, he goes to address the United Nations again on the issue of whether mutants with artificially created mutations should be given the same legal rights and protections as those born mutants. Eric is in favor. As he walks along Madison Avenue, enjoying a bright, cool fall day in New York City, a young woman staring at a shop window draws his attention. There's something familiar about her. "Mobius," he says. She turns. "It always happens," Mobius says. "Anywhere I go, always another client. But I never dreamed you would want to relive your life, Enigma. Not after all you've done." Relive it. Again. The temptation wells up. He could go back again. Do it all over. Except this time, he would keep Charles from going to Uganda. Keep him close and safe. Make sure that Charles got to lead the long life he deserved. But Eric has learned a lot about fate and chance these past 5 decades. Charles was indeed his own man. He would have taken his own risks. There would be no way to guarantee his safety without denying him his freedom and his heroism. If he went to find Charles earlier, if he saved him from Kurt Marko the way he once wished he had, would Charles still grow into the man he ultimately became? There's no way to know, and Eric does not intend to spend eternity experimenting with Charles's life, or his own. "I already have relived my life," he says. "I suppose you wouldn't remember." Her eyebrows lift in evident surprise. "Did you pay the price? Did you give up what you loved most?" Eric's initial thought is of Charles, dead decades before he ought to have been. But with the perspective of another lifetime, he knows. Charles wasn't what he loved most, not when he sought Mobius out. He loved and treasured his own anger, and thought it the most powerful force at his command. Yet it never stood a chance against his mother, or Charles, or any of the life he's had instead. "I did," he says to Mobius, "and the price was worth paying." The end.
Once I was 7 years old, Mama told me, go make yourself some friends or you'll be lonely. Once I was 7 years old. Once I was 7 years old.
Reader's notes. This story is a companion piece to another story Yahtzee has written called Undone. There's a great podfic of it by Podcath that I suggest you go check out if you haven't already. Thank you to Yahtzee for having blanket permission to record their fic. If you'd like to find this fic online, it can be found at archiveofourown.org/works/269859. If you'd like to download this podfic, it can be found at pedicaproductions.com. Thanks for listening.
Once I was 7 years old, my mama told me, go make yourself some friends or you'll be lonely. Once I was 7 years old. It was a big, big world, but we thought we were bigger, pushing each other to the limits. We were learning quicker by 11, smoking herb and drinking burning liquor. Never rich, so we were out to make that steady figure. Once I was 11 years old, my daddy told me, go get yourself a wife or you'll be lonely. Once I was 11 years old. So I started writing songs, I started writing stories. Something about that glory just always seemed to bore me, cause only those I really love will ever really know me. Once I was 20 years old, my story got told before the morning sun when life was lonely. Once I was 20 years old. Only see my goals, I don't believe in failure, cause I know the smallest voices, they can make it major. I got my boys with me, at least those in favor, and if we don't meet before I leave, I hope I'll see you later. Once I was 20 years old, my story got told, I was writing about everything I saw before. Songs have been sold, we've traveled around the world and we're still roaming. Soon we'll be 30 years old. I'm still learning about life, my woman brought children for me, so I can sing them all my songs and I can tell them stories. Most of my boys are with me, some are still out seeking glory, and some I had to leave behind, my brother, I'm still savvy. Soon I'll be 60 years old, my daddy got 61, remember life and then your life becomes a better one. I made a man so happy when I wrote a letter once. Children come and visit once or twice a month. Soon I'll be 60 years old. Will I think the world is cold? Or will I have a lot of children who can bore me? Soon I'll be 60 years old. Soon I'll be 60 years old. Will I think the world is cold? Or will I have a lot of children who can bore me? Soon. Once I was 7 years old, my mama told me, go make yourself some friends or you'll be lonely. Once I was 7 years old. Once I was 7 years old.